Good morning.
Good morning.
This morning I'm going to start talking about the Bodhisattva precepts. I haven't talked to Jocko. I'm trying to persuade her to do it too, so we just go back and forth and cover the 10 precepts. We have several people who are taking Jukai and receiving the precepts, sewing a Roksu. We'll probably have the ceremony in September. This is a Roksu. And this is the ceremony of saying out loud to the community and to the world that you're going to do your best to follow the Buddha way, to do your best to follow the precepts, among other things. And also, to become part of the lineage of Buddha's way in an official kind of capacity. So part of this is taking the 13 Bodhisattva precepts. The first three are the pure precepts, which are to do good, to avoid evil, and to benefit all beings. Then there are 10, what are called 10 prohibitory precepts, and then there's also taking refuge. So what I want to talk about are the 10, what are called the 10 prohibitory precepts. I don't know about the word prohibitory, but that's commonly what they're called. So the first one is do not kill. Do not kill in some ways is a vast topic, which I cannot cover here today, unless we want to stay. We'll have the do not kill lecture shishin that lasted for many days. Maybe we could say it lasts for the rest of our lives. Anyway, a way to talk about this precept, Robert Aiken presents a way to talk about this precept in his book, Mind of Clover. So I thought this was kind of interesting. He says that the precepts have three aspects, three kinds of views. I think this is really helpful in understanding the precept of do not kill. So the three are a kind of understanding them in a literal way, in a conventional literal way, understanding them in a with a view of compassion, interconnectedness, nurturing, or empathy. And the third way would be understanding them as a kind of essential non-dual teaching. So I want to talk about those three ways. First, I want to talk about understanding this precept, not killing, from the perspective of non-duality. So we could say, from the perspective of everything being completely interpenetrating, interconnected, that we could say, well, there's no killer. There's no one who's killed or no thing that's killed, and there's no such thing as death. But I think that understanding or only understanding the precept this way is really problematic. Because I think that if we understand this precept, this view, without incorporating the other views, then what we have is this misunderstanding about non-duality that's nihilistic. We say, well, if everything's the same, if everything is all one thing, if there's no killing, there's nothing being killed, there's no death, then what does it matter? Then I can just do whatever I want to do. So that's a problem. So when we talk about this, we'll say there is no inherently existing death, no inherently existing birth. So this means that we're talking about from this position of everything is one activity. Everything is, as Dogen would say, Zenki, the whole works. Everything is engaged together, making this world. So when we understand it from that perspective, then out of that comes this precept. Out of this comes all the precepts. This way in which we understand that we are in this interconnected relationship. And that so what that means is that we want to do good. We want to do what is most skillful. We want to enact this complete interconnectedness of all beings. So from that perspective, we don't get caught in nihilism. But the problem is when we do get caught in nihilism and get confused about it. And I think that this can be a real problem. So I think that I don't want to dwell on this as a specific way to think about the precept of not killing. Not dwell on it in the sense of not taking it out of context. The other way of looking at not killing is to say the literal view of do not kill. So I think this is kind of, again, this is taking these as isolated ways of talking about this, isolated ways of viewing this. So if we take it from the literal view, in actuality, we cannot do this precept from a literal point of view. We cannot live our lives from the perspective of never killing. Because, first of all, we eat. And what do we eat? We eat things that have been alive. We eat plants, we eat meat, we eat all these various things. And so in that way, just on the face of it, we cannot sustain our lives without killing. So we can't follow this precept in a literal way. It just doesn't work. It's just not, it's not possible. So the other problem with following the precept literally is that you become rigid. So our practice is, remember Dogen says, as I like to quote in the Genjo Koan, to carry the self forward is illusion, to allow myriad things to come forth is realization. These myriad things coming forth means that we're responding to the totality of our life. So that's the kind of baseline of how we cultivate skillful means. So if we have this really rigid view of what is right and wrong, then we're trying to overlay some notion that we have about how we're supposed to respond 100% in every situation. And life doesn't work that way. So it's not that cut and dried. And when we get that mindset, then we become very rigid. We also usually also become quite critical because we see other people who are not following our ideas about what's right and wrong, and then we criticize them or we criticize ourselves for not doing this. So again, this is a view I don't think that works very well, particularly with this precept. This precept in some ways is complicated. It's a messy precept. It's a difficult precept. And of course, it's the first precept. So the second view, so we're talking about this view of complete non-duality, which can be problematic if applied incorrectly. Then we've talked about the view from the perspective of there's just one way to do this thing, so that isn't very workable either. So what's in the middle? What is this middle way? So this is this what Eckhart Roshi is calling the compassionate view. So in this compassionate view, we can't avoid killing. We can't really avoid killing. Not in this kind of literal, dualistic way. And yet at the same time, there is killing. At the same time, there is this way in which it's not just about some notion of complete non-duality. Non-duality only manifests in the particular. There is no such thing as non-duality in the abstract. It's an abstract notion. We say no inherently existing thing. We could say the emptiness of emptiness, but to say the emptiness of emptiness is really just a way of deconstructing or breaking our rigid concept of the notion of what emptiness is. So emptiness itself, this non-duality, is really expressed in the particular. And so when we're talking about the particular, we're talking about how do we respond to our life? How do we respond to what's actually happening? So this view, what Eckhart Roshi calls the compassionate view, is the view that holds both of those things simultaneously. So this is the only way that we can actually enact and relate to our lives. This way in which we have this interconnectedness, interbeing, the way of reality and the meaning, and how it manifests in a particular situation. So how do we respond to suffering? How do we avoid causing harm? How do we respond to this unavoidability of this interconnected life that we live, this messy life that we live? How do we engage in continuously practicing and supporting all beings and supporting all being and supporting ourselves simultaneously? How do we do this in the midst of our suffering? How do we do this in the midst of our joy, which is usually not a question we ask, by the way. We just accept joy. But we do ask this question in suffering because we don't like to suffer. So we're like, when we suffer, we pay attention. When we're joyous, we're usually just doing it, right? We're just enjoying it. So how we answer these questions is how we interact with our daily life. So how we do this reveals how we understand our life, what we believe, and how we find meaning. So precepts help us to find this for ourselves. So this precept of do not kill, I think, is really helpful in this way to talk about this. Another way to think about this precept is to think about our precepts in general, is that they are the enactment of the Buddhist spirit, the enactment of our spirit of our practice, the enactment of Buddha's way. They are what Dogen calls the dignified behavior of a Buddha. They are just the daily activities that we engage in. With this mind, with this spirit, with this vow, to save all beings, which I think is a little abstract. But in the morning when we do the rope chant, we vow to benefit all beings. So this vow that we have to benefit all beings, this vow that we have to actually embody and to enact this compassion that arises from our interconnected nature, which can be really tough, you know? It's like if you don't like somebody and you're trying to respond to them from this position of, oh, we're the same, right? We share the same. That's really hard to do. So how do we do that in a kind of intelligent way? How do we engage with that? So this Buddhist way also involves faith. It also involves trust. It involves trust in our willingness to explore the nature of what this precept means. So part of this is that we have to really look at what we're up to when we talk about this precept. We have to look at things like, are we rationalizing things? Are we saying to ourselves, well, it's okay to kill because I have a reason for doing it? That's one way to look at it. And I think when we do that, so sometimes when we rationalize things, we just say, oh, it's okay to do this, and then we forget about it. So can we look at this so that we say, oh, that's the kind of superficial response I have to it. But what's the deeper response to it? So if I kill an insect or a spider or something like that, or I kill a bug that's in my house, so my rationalization for that might be, oh, they're dirty. I'm killing this fly because it carries germs. But let's look deeper into that reason for why we're killing a fly. Look deeper into the reality of that. You know, what is that about? And realize that it's a rationalization. And when we do that, we might say, well, okay, that may be a reason why I'm killing the fly, but that's not a reason to necessarily kill the fly. Maybe what I need to do is figure out a way to get the fly out of the house by opening the doors. So this way that we go beyond our kind of first mindset, our first idea about what we're up to, so that we have a deeper notion of what might be the appropriate action in that situation. So this is a real practical way to talk about our bodhisattva vow, about how we're responding to things. So we have to keep kind of returning to our altruistic vow, returning to our vow of not wanting to cause harm, and at the same time engaging with that as a problematic issue, that it's also a difficult and complicated issue. So I'll give you an example. So earlier this week in St. Paul, the police officer, I'm probably say his name wrong, it's Yanez, I think, was acquitted for killing Philando Castile while he was in his car. So this is the one where the woman live streamed on Facebook. I don't think he was her husband, but her partner being killed with the child in the backseat. So the policeman that killed him was just acquitted. And they showed us the dash cam. Now that's on the news, right? The actual dash cam from the police car's perspective of what happened. And so, you know, the young man said, I have a license, I have a gun in the car. The policeman said, don't pull it out. And I guess we don't see that part. I guess at this point he goes to pull out his wallet and he says to the policeman, he says, I am not, something like, I'm not doing that, or I'm not pulling the gun out. And the cop gets really excited and starts yelling, don't do that, don't do that, don't pull it out, don't pull it out, and shoots him like 7 or 8 times. Okay? So this is kind of my best effort to give you an unbiased view of this. So this is now we're talking about the precept not killing, right? So what is essentially going on here? I think what essentially is going on here in the common denominator of all these stories about people being killed, usually African Americans, all these stories, is fear. People are frightened. The policeman who shot him, there was no gap in there. And the same thing about the little boy who was shot in the drive-by, right? I call it drive-by. The police came shooting by, shot the kid who was 12 or something because he had a toy gun. With the story about the little boy, the woman who called in the dispatcher didn't say that the child had a gun. She just said, he has what, I can't tell what it is. Maybe it's a gun, maybe it's a toy gun. So there was this ambiguity in there. But somehow in the course of people's fear, and that's what I think it is, it becomes unambiguous to them. Like they are so caught up in this emotion, they are so completely freaked out, that it all goes out of their mind. I'm sure the police probably take some kind of vow to do good. I don't know what their ceremony is for when they become officers, but I suspect that it includes, like being a doctor, right, this vow to do good, to serve the public. And yet, fear drives that completely out of our minds. Fear drives our practice completely out of our minds. So there's this dominant theme in which a person's fear, and that fear can be prejudiced, it can be cultural, it can be any of the reasons that we can think of why people end up with this mindset of fear. It's this fear that drives them to completely forget whatever their most altruistic intentions are, and to respond in a way with this incredible violence, and to kill. And by the way, this killing that we do, this is an extreme example, but it's very much prevalent in our culture right now. It's very much in our minds. It's very confusing because, for the most part, the police have not been convicted for any of these situations, and that's very confusing. But I'm not necessarily going to, I don't want to get into the pros and cons of this about that. What I find interesting from a practice point of view is, and particularly this example, is that just raw, visceral fear. And the young man who was shot, it was pretty clear to me that he was trying to do what you're supposed to do if you're African American and stopped by the police. You're supposed to stay calm. You're supposed to be honest. You're supposed to do this thing. And so he stayed calm. He stayed this way, and it was to no avail, really, because fear is such an overwhelming emotion. So I think this is a cautionary tale for us as practitioners to pay attention to our lives on a daily basis, moment by moment, and say, what is it? What is it? What am I doing in this situation? How can I cultivate my practice? And this isn't just about whether or not we're killing, but this precept, we are talking about killing today. So if you're going around your house stomping bugs, you know, or you're freaked out because there's a spider in your house, then maybe you might give some spaciousness to that and think about the fear that's coming up in you about this particular being that's in your space. To look at that and say, this fear is motivating me to do something that's unskillful. Is there another way that I can respond? Can I just, what I do, if I can, I put a glass over the spider, right, and slip a piece of paper underneath it and take it outside. So can I do that instead of like, you know, there's a spider in my house. So we have to be conscious about what we're doing, and we have to create a kind of space around that. And sometimes, you know, we do kill intentionally. We do kill things. We have ants in our house, and I think I wrote a weekly quote, something about the ant crawling across the floor in the bathroom that I was watching one day with lots of equanimity. But then at a certain point, it got to the place where there were ants everywhere in our house. I'd sit at my keyboard and look at my hand, and there'd be an ant crawling across my hand. And so finally, I just said, I'm getting ant traps. So I got ant traps and have, you know, pretty much done away with the ants that have been in the house. I know, it's a sad thing. We kill snails, you know, that are in our garden. We kill, you know, rats if they're in our house. We don't want rats in our house with us. So there's this way in which we have to acknowledge the fact that, yeah, we do actually intentionally kill. So we're also engaged in that activity too. And what, you know, what is that about? Just to think about that. Maybe one way to respond to doing something like that is to have a ceremony. Once a year, have a ceremony at your house and say, I have empathy for those beings that I've killed throughout the course of this year. This kind of gratitude and an acknowledgement of taking life. When we were over in the other space, it's funny, there was that little white Buddha statue that was about this big that was in the closet, and it got covered with this kind of incrustation. Well, it turned out that incrustation was termites. That was like, to put it graphically, I guess, termite poop, right? They like excrete this. And I didn't know what it was. And somebody said, well, there are termites in here. So we called the landlord, and he came and zapped all the termites. So we put the termites up on the remembrance board for 49 days for the life of the termites that we had caused to be dead. So this way that we can acknowledge what we're up to. So another example about this is that it's talking again about eating, killing, when we eat, things that we eat. Suzuki Roshi said, our existence is the result of sacrificing many animals and plants. So as long as you are involved in dualistic concepts about precepts, it's not possible for you to observe the precepts. So there's two ideas here. One is that we can't avoid killing in this way because about eating, talking about eating plants or animals. So how can we respond to that? And again, we can respond to that with gratitude. We can respond to that by acknowledging that we are in this position of what Dogen calls continuous practice. So this is a way to positively talk about non-duality. In Gyoji, or continuous practice, Dogen talks about how the whole world is engaged in the process of making the world. So our nurturance, nurturing ourselves through eating, staying alive through eating, which is true, of course, for everything. Everything is eating something. Everything is consuming something, transforming something into an energy that it can use to sustain its own life. So how is this? We need to acknowledge that. We need to see that that is the process, one of the processes of our world, one of the ways in which we are sustained by other beings in the world, and to cultivate gratitude for that. That's one of the nice things, actually, about doing a blessing, right, before you eat. And in our Zen tradition, we say, you know, innumerable labors brought us this food. These innumerable labors include the labor of somebody picking or whatever, but it also includes this life. It includes this life that has been given to sustain us. So that we are aware of that, which helps us come back to this way in which we understand the world as a totality, as a process that we have deep gratitude for. And when we have deep gratitude for things, we also have respect for them. We start to have more respect for our carrots, more respect for the beings that sustain us. Dogen says in Tenso Kyokan, he says, you know, lettuce, treat a lettuce as Buddha. Each leaf of lettuce is Buddha. Each little ant in my house is Buddha. Each little rat that I kill is Buddha. And I also, from an altruistic kind of view of perhaps naivete, I don't know, a view of what's right and what's wrong, I might say, well, I should never kill a rat. I should just live with the rats. They should just come and be part of my life. I'm sorry, that's not possible. So this way in which we realize that we have these ideals of what we would like our life to be like, and then we have the reality of what it is to be a human being in this life, what it is to be in this life. So how do we acknowledge and reconcile? I think that's the thing that's talking about the precept of not killing from this perspective, I think is very profound. This way in which we have to accept that we don't live in an ideal world. We have to accept that there's this way in which we are going to engage in activity that doesn't fit that ideal. And how do we work with that? How do we acknowledge that? How do we find the reality of our Bodhisattva Buddha life? Not the ideal of how we think it should be. So that would be following the precept literally, which we cannot do. So if we have this literal minded idea of the precepts, and we say, I cannot kill ever, which we're not going to be able to do, do we beat ourselves up? Do we ignore it and act like it doesn't exist? How do we respond to that? So I think that's a kind of like the koan of this precept, the thing that's compelling about this precept. There are so many ways we can talk about not killing. We can say not killing is about not killing our spirit. That's another way to talk about it. And so that's a very interesting conversation. But I think it's interesting to just look at this perspective, just look at this precept from the perspective of not killing. No, nothing nuanced about it, but just not taking life. And how difficult that would be and impossible to be for us to do it. So How do we respond to that? Another thing Suzuki Roshi said, he said, whether or not we eat fish or meat is not because to do so is to violate the precepts. I thought that was interesting. It's not about violating the precepts to eat meat or fish. So we like to think, oh, being vegetarian is best. I think that's what he's saying here. We like to say, oh, being a vegetarian is the best thing, so that's what I should do. That's how I should kind of reconcile myself with this precept. But he's saying, no, it's not about that. He says, whether or not we eat fish or meat is not because to do so is to violate the precepts. It is because it might not be appropriate food for us. It might not be appropriate food for us. Now, unfortunately, in this lecture, he did not elaborate on that. So I'm left to my own devices to elaborate on what Suzuki Roshi may or may not have meant. But here's what I think he meant. So what's appropriate? Health needs, food availability, sustainability. Like, for example, Tibetan Buddhists eat meat. One of the reasons they do is because it's not a big agricultural country. Tibet doesn't have a lot of fertile soil to, you know, do corn and all that. So they eat meat. So Tibetan Buddhists don't even worry about that. When I was at Tassajara, some Tibetan teachers came down to, I can't remember who it was, some guy, a tulku with his entourage, and they brought steak with them. They had these filet mignon that was already cooked because we didn't really have cooking meat. Tassar is vegetarian. It's like, oh, my goodness, somebody brought meat. Now, not when I left Tassajara, when we all, many of us, when we leave Tassajara, go, I need hamburgers, but for some reason the idea of somebody bringing steak down to Tassajara was like a really big deal. So these guys are like, but this is what they eat. They eat meat, right? And I know people who eat meat because meat is what actually sustains their body. That's what, it's good for them to get the nourishment. Some of us eat meat because, well, we like to eat meat. So there's this way in which we make these distinctions that in some ways are, again, this would be like this way of saying this is a literal, trying to rationalize how do we work with this literal precept of do not kill. So we say, well, I'm going to rationalize that because I'm going to say, I'm going to kill plants and eat them, but I'm not going to kill meat. I'm not going to have meat. I'm not going to eat fish. So it's interesting to look about that, and Suzuki Roshi saying, no, that's actually not the question. The question is it appropriate? Is it appropriate? So So health needs, availability, and sustainability, what is sustainable. So I started thinking about this. Well, okay, let's talk about how we think about this notion of not killing. Maybe what we think about is how we treat and understand the beings that we're eating. So if we respond to acknowledge that the cow that I eat is Buddha, the chicken that I eat is Buddha, the fish that I eat are Buddha, the eggs that I eat are Buddha, the carrot that I eat is Buddha. So if I look at that, then I have to ask myself, how do these things come to me? How is it that I respond to these things? Is this a cow that has, if I'm able to do this, because some people aren't, I am, but some people are not able to, say, afford to buy organic food or afford to buy food that's 100%, you know, meat that's 100% grass-fed. But if I can do that, then that's maybe something I need to look at. I say, how is it? What was the life like of this cow? Now, I know we make jokes about when you go to what... I can't remember the name of this program, but, you know, it's like you go to the restaurant.
Portlandia.
You go to the restaurant, and the waiter says, and this cow's name was Joe, and they were, you know, raised on this little acre here and ate this grass. And we make fun of that, but actually what that extreme represents is this way in which someone's sincerely trying to understand the nature of the life of this being that they are eating. So that we pay attention to that, that we ask ourselves, what are the conditions of the person who helped to create, you know, helped to bring this food to my table? Are they, you know, working in a field that's filled with pesticides and it's detrimental to their health? So these kinds of thinking, and again, it's complicated, right? It's complicated. As a middle-class person, I could sit here and talk about this and say, yeah, I go to New Leaf, I buy 100% grass-fed beef, you know, but there's somebody else who's going and buying, you know, something else that's not 100% grass-fed. Does that mean I'm a better person than they are? No, it doesn't mean that. But what I'm trying to say here is that just to think about these things, to go beyond the surface of this question and ask yourself, you know, what can I do? How can I cultivate my gratitude? How can I acknowledge that the whole universe, but in particular, these particular beings are helping to sustain me? So I think that this is a very practical way and practice-oriented way, and a way that we acknowledge that we live in an interconnected world. This is the way, I think, the appropriate way to acknowledge that we are interpenetrating and interconnected with all being. That it is the absolute opposite of nihilism. It's the opposite of taking and taking and taking and taking and not thinking about where it's coming from. So in this way, I would encourage you to think about this precept of not killing. Thank you.